This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. The demand to free Centoya is growing. Celebrities, protesters, and activists are joining forces to amplify the request for clemency for Centoya Brown. She's serving a life sentence in Tennessee for killing a man who solicited her for sex when she was 16 years old. Advocates say her case illuminates the unjust treatment of black women in the American penal system. Outgoing Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam has said he is considering the clemency request. Just one of the many topics we'll talk about today on Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Later, we'll review Michelle Obama's memoir, Becoming, and a new HBO documentary about the life and death of Sandra Bland. Plus, hip-hop journalist Joan Morgan joins the conversation to talk about the enduring legacy of Lauryn Hill's 20-year-old album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Joining me for that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thank you, Frank.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He is an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back.
What's up, Frank?
Let's talk more about Centoya Brown. Mark, tell us the story.
She was basically a young girl who was caught in a situation of sex trafficking and resisted a man trying to force her, you know, into having sex and further on into, you know, sex trafficking. And she killed him in an act of self-defense. And essentially, she has been in jail since she was 16 years old for trying to protect herself in an act of self-defense.
And she was given a life sentence. The Supreme Court has since ruled on whether or not, ruled that it is not constitutional to give minors life without parole, and yet she is still there. She was granted a clemency hearing this year after citing this 2012 Supreme Court ruling that I just cited, that life without parole is unconstitutional for juveniles. Let's hear Centoya Brown at her hearing earlier this year.
When you really realize that you've done something you can't undo, like it stays with you, and it stayed with me this whole time. You know, that people here today that, like, I hurt, they're hurting now, 14 years later. They've been hurting for 14 years, and I did that. And I can't fix it. I can't fix it. Like, I had to change because I could not live with myself being the same person that did that.
That's a clip of Centoya Brown speaking at her clemency hearing before the Tennessee Board of Parole in May of this year. She's serving a life sentence for killing a man who solicited her for sex. And I'm talking about that story and more with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, what do you make of this story?
Well, I just listening to Centoya in the clip you just played just breaks my heart. Because, I mean, you hear the remorse that she feels for having taken a life, right? Even though it was in self-defense, even though she was clearly a victim, she was a minor, and this man, was going to traffic her and prostitute her. And I think the thing that really bothers me about this case is that, you know, Centoya has to, at least at this point, she's got to serve 51 years of this life term at the very least before she can even be up for parole. And she's 30 now, I think. And there are so many predators. There are so many men who have been convicted of sex trafficking, sexual assault, rape, and so forth. And they've gotten, some, you know, much smaller sentences. I mean, and they've had multiple victims. And so the hypocrisy, the contradiction, just the injustice that this young woman who absolutely was trying to defend herself against a predator who she killed in self-defense. I mean, there we know that there are people who have gotten off on the claim that they were defending themselves, right? Trayvon Martin, I mean, the list goes on and on. So it just bothers me that she is in this situation and that really her only hope is clemency by this Tennessee governor.
You know, to Natalie's point, thinking about the Stanford swimmer from last summer or the young fraternity president who was just let off on a light sentence.
Right.
by the judge. I mean, so it's these contradictions, right?
Well, yeah, because when you allow in those cases what the other party was doing, was the woman drinking? Did they give permission at some point? How were they dressed? If you're talking about a sexual assault or a rape case, all of this is entered into the evidence and somehow mitigates the right. charge. Remember, we've been saying here that she did this in self-defense, and it would be pretty clear to anyone who had seen the evidence, I think, that it was self-defense. However, the fact is that she was convicted in court of first-degree murder in this case with all that evidence. So, I mean, that speaks to your point, Natalie. The fact that she could, as a minor, that she could be convicted of first-degree murder when all of these questions about the circumstances of the shooting were in play. And as you say, the mitigating circumstances that are allowed in other cases. Well, it is not lost on activists. It's obviously caught a lot of celebrity attention. Kim Kardashian, Rihanna came out in support last year. And others, a number of artists have joined in the demand. And let's talk about this because there was a public television show in Tennessee, ostensibly about education, higher education, where the outgoing governor appeared. Bill Haslam was on the show. And there was a chance for question and answer after that program or during the program. And here's a clip of an interaction with an audience member that starts with audience member Justin Lang.
Centoria Brown is currently serving year 14 of a life sentence for the murder of Johnny Allen, a 43-year-old who purchased her for sex at the age of 16. Centoria was acting in self-defense as Allen was attempting to assault her. As a victim of sex trafficking and assault, this is an unjust sentence in the first place. And so I ask, why has Centoria Brown been incarcerated for 14 years for enduring harm? And so I say, Governor Haslam, you have the power and ability to grant clemency to Centoria Brown. And so I ask, when will you grant her clemency?
Here's, I think, what the best way to say that. We are in the midst of reviewing Centoria's case. I will say this. We're reviewing a lot of cases. And while Centoria's case has gotten a lot of publicity, I don't think you want us to treat hers any different than a whole lot of cases that I think people want us to review to see if it's been handled well.
Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam speaking at a live televised forum earlier this month on USA Today Network. Mark, the fact that this has gotten attention, does it mean that we're finally paying attention to this and that you expect some change? Or is it, as Haslam suggests, only this one case and not some of the deeper questions?
Well, you know, because of social media and Twitter in particular, this is a story that has been kind of bubbling into consciousness for about 4 or 5 years. We're starting to see the moment now, though, where we're starting to see the limitations of celebrity buy-in to these causes, right? We haven't necessarily seen when celebrities buy in that it actually moves the needle the way that it needs to move. We do have to have a conversation, though, more broadly beyond Centoria, about these kinds of sentences and how we think about women who protect themselves and what that looks like in the context of race. There was a young woman in Florida a few years ago who was being domestically abused, intimate partner abused by her husband, you know, who just shot a rifle up in the air, right? And she ended up going to jail for 20 years at least being sentenced for 20 years for that.
Right. You stand your ground as her defense. And that was not, legitimate in the court's eyes for her case.
In the state of Florida.
In the state of Florida.
Well, let us turn now to a different controversy. This is the one that surrounds the collection of figurines from Prada. They're called Prada Malia, and a display of figurines in Prada's Soho, New York store drew quite a bit of attention last week for what many called racist imagery. Mark, tell us more about this.
So Prada's selling these $550 keychains that are figurines that to everyone who has any passing knowledge of race politics in the United States, it looks like a monkey in blackface.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not even a blackface. It looked like a monkey in blackface. And they got called out. You're wondering who is sitting there around a table in 2018 and says, hey, this is a good idea. Right. And then when Prada is pressed, the response is, well, this is not based on real people. This is actually based on some sort of fantasy world that we're and it's like their response was more inflammatory than the actual dolls themselves. at least you could say, okay, we made a mistake. But then to buy into the mistake and say, no, that's not what we intended. There was a black woman who worked at the store who pushed back, who was transferred to another site. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous in 2018.
Yeah, and I just think that what Prada, the tone deafness, the blind spots, like everything is, you know, just ringing out that you don't get it. But I think what's most egregious is that it's so easy to do just a little homework, just a little research to get some context and some history about what you're doing. And then the fact that, you know, to Mark's point about who was at the table when these decisions were being made, no diversity. Like, clearly, if someone black had been at the table, there's no way they would have moved forward with, you know, with these figurines. And now, I mean, you know, they've they've said that Prada has said that they will donate the proceeds of the figurines to an organization in New York that is devoted to racial justice. I don't know that quite gets it. You know, that's just not enough.
Well, the representation, we only have about 30 seconds left, but the representation question here is key. I mean, not only is somebody black, anybody with like any kind of sense of cultural history
they
at all.
They could have walked out of the Soho store, pulled any black person off the street and asked them, is this offensive to you?
I think 30% of white people would see this is Little Black Sambo and cannot be. You're not going to sell this for 8 cents. This is, well, anyway, Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State, Mark Anthony Neal, distinguished professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, and our conversation on Back Channel will continue. This is the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Back Channel today, a recurring series connecting culture and context with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and a teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Mark is the James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. He's an author and also the host of the webcast Left of Black. I want to turn the conversation now to Temple University Professor Mark Lamont Hill. This is a very interesting story. He recently fired from his role as CNN commentator following comments he made to the United Nations that some were said were anti-Semitic. It's a long speech, but let's listen to, I think, the phrase at toward the very end of the speech that seems to have gotten him in hot water.
We have an opportunity to not just offer solidarity in words, but to commit to political action, grassroots action, local action, and international action that will give us what justice requires. And that is a free Palestine from the river to the sea.
As Temple University Professor Mark Lamont Hill, he was speaking to the United Nations last month, later fired from his role as CNN commentator. And we're talking about it with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. And of course, this was a speech in solidarity with the Palestinians, very critical of Israel. Natalie, what do you make of the speech and the reaction to it?
Well, I mean, I think that Mark made a compelling, to say the least, appeal to the UN on behalf of Palestinians. And I think that the points that he made in terms of human rights and human rights offenses is absolutely legitimate. I think that the outrage over the last line of his speech, while I understand that it is something that Hamas, which is a terrorist group, a Palestinian terrorist group has used, is at the same time, what I think is missing is that I don't feel like in the moment, Mark Lamont Hill was able to really, he wasn't really given the chance to explain what he meant. And I think that what he said while I understand how inflammatory it is, people ran with it. And the interpretation became more important than what he actually was talking about. And I think that's really problematic and dangerous in a democracy because it totally kind of assaults the idea of free speech.
Mark?
It's a trigger phrase. There's no question about that. I'm confident that Mark didn't use it for that reason, for that trigger, but was making a comparative relationship between what happened to the Jewish folks within the Jewish faith and obviously, you know, what's happening in Palestine. You know, one of the things that Mark speaks a great deal about, you know, mainstream American media doesn't cover what life looks like in the occupied territory. And from everyone that I've talked to who spent any time there, particularly Americans who go there for the first time, they're absolutely floored by the conditions. And this is something that has impacted him enough that he's taking trips back there two or three times a year to kind of speak to that reality, hence his reason for speaking at the UN that day. You know, Mark was fired from Fox before CNN, right? So this is not the first time. In that case, it was because of his relationship with Mumia Abu-Jamal. He had done a book with him, and Fox was very sensitive to, you know, law enforcement in that context. Mm-hmm. And obviously, CNN being this huge media corporation.
A progressive media.
But, you know, they are sensitive to charges of anti-Semitism, whether or not they agree or disagree with Mark's statement. I think when we got to the moment where we're hearing Temple University talking about either taking away his tenure or firing him, you know, he's protected by academic freedom in that context.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of issues here at various levels, but let's talk about just one, and that is the phrase itself. And this really gets back to Prada to some extent. That phrase has powerful impact on Jewish listeners in particular and others who are sensitive to what's going on, that particular phrase. So there is, on the one hand, a broad critique of the state of Israel and its treatment of the Palestinian people, which is a fair critique, and I think anyone who is, as you say, who's seen what's happening to the Palestinian people and a person of conscience should take notice at what the state of Israel is doing to the Palestinian people in that speech. Then you use a phrase that means to many Jews the annihilation of the Jewish state and the death of Jewish people, that right. particular phrase, right. and you wonder if you couldn't have made the same speech without the phrase.
Well, I was just going to say, the way that Mark delivered that line, to me, it seemed like he was reclaiming it to use it in a different way, to say something that's much more expansive than the way that it's been used to inflame protest and terror. And so, again, I just feel like that is what has been focused on to the detriment of everything right. else that he right. said. It was a 20-something minute speech.
Right. Right.
And so that to me, you know, I just have a problem with the idea that, while I understand it, because, you know, if somebody ended an appeal to the UN on police brutality in America against African Americans and ended with the N-word, mm-hmm. you know, I'd have a problem with that. I think that at the heart of this is just this, we're missing the fact that there is a power dynamic that is at the heart of the Israel versus Palestine situation, in the same way that there is a power dynamic that exists in our country between white and black, white and non-white people.
Yeah.
And I think that is really what Mark Lamont Hill was trying to get at.
Very much so. And I wonder if really the more controversial statement should not have been, and the one that would have gotten him in the hottest water, because it was so accurate, so incisive. And the thing that scares the power structure in this country the most is what he said immediately before that. Let's listen.
And as we protested, I saw two things that provided hope for the Palestinian struggle. One was that for the first time in my entire life of activism, I saw a sea of Palestinian people. I saw a sea of Palestinian flags in the crowd saying that we must form a solidarity project. We must struggle together in order to resist, because state violence in the United States and state violence in Brazil and state violence in Syria and state violence in Egypt and state violence in South Africa and state violence in Palestine are all of the same sort. And we finally understood that we must work together and not turn on each other, but instead turn to each other.
That's Mark Lay. He was talking about protest in Ferguson, Missouri there, right, where he talked about that solidarity, and that seems to be the point that, unfortunately, we're now talking about.
Yeah, Mark is a black internationalist, right? And we think about them as an older generation of black activists, kind of the Paul Robeson generation, if you will. So the fact that you have this man who literally just turned 40 yesterday, you know, who's thinking in such a global level about global resistance and solidarity, there is something particularly dangerous about that. And there's a way in which you could argue, because this is the thing, right? Everybody who's pro-Palestinian doesn't ride with Hamas. Right. And doesn't ride with terrorists.
Right.
I mean, that's just the reality of it.
Right.
And in some ways, you have to do a lot of work to read, right, a terrorist threat in what Mark is saying. Right. You would have to misread his intent in that context.
That's right.
And there clearly were people who were willing to misread it. But again, there is some onus of responsibility perhaps on Mark. Why don't you not use the phrase? Right. And that's always a question. Yeah. Right. But again, we're talking about a society here in the United States where folks are vastly illiterate about what is happening in Palestine. So it only resonates in one way when they hear that phrase.
Yeah, I just want to jump in to say this one little thing, which is I think that we suffer in this country increasingly so from an anti-intellectual spirit. Like, we are not trying to hear or think about nuance. Right. And what Mark said is so important, that you can be pro-Palestinian and not be anti-Semitic.
Right.
You can be anti-Zionist and not be down with Hamas. And that is, right, you know, right, that's a big part of the problem.
You can be anti-Zionist and pro-Jewish.
There you go. Thank you. Right. Right. Exactly.
As many in Israel are.
There you go.
Right. So, I mean, I think it points to all of that and the fact that we're not having the discussion, and the fact that it's lost on a lot of people, this sort of, you know, state violence against the people in Brazil. He names all those countries, including the United States of America and Israel. And again, I think if you take the sort of anti-intellectual approach that we take to discussion in the United States, you don't even see that state-sponsored terrorism is covered by the language of law. When you pass
right.
something in the Knesset or the United States Congress and it's called, you know, the stand your ground
right.
law,
right.
that's not terrorism. But in another state where you can kill people who don't look like you, that would be called terrorism.
Absolutely.
Right? And because
Absolutely.
You're a non-state actor. And
right.
so this is part of, I think, what this discussion could open up if we were ever to have that kind of discussion in the United States of America.
Right. Will we? Will we, though?
Don't ask me. Let's talk about somebody who did generate a conversation that people are able to engage in, and that is the conversation about Michelle Obama's new book. Her memoir, Becoming, has sold more than 3 million copies so far. Fastest selling nonfiction book of all time. She's on a major book tour, at a press tour, and I want to listen to play a clip here of a conversation she had about her book with Oprah in November. And she's talking about her upbringing on the south side of Chicago, and she mentions Dandy, which is her grandfather.
So in many ways, when you grew up, or at least when I grew up, I had to learn how to be bilingual. I had to learn how to talk in a way that would get me to school without getting my butt kicked.
Yeah.
And I had to talk in a certain way that would allow me to continue to strive and get those gold stars and to, you know, push towards what my parents and grandparents had hoped for me, because also the way I talked was something that was drilled into me by Dandy.
And that's Michelle Obama talking with Oprah last month on the release of her new memoir, Becoming. Natalie, the memoir is split into three parts, actually: Becoming Me, Becoming Us, and then Becoming More. So it's more than just her childhood, but that was certainly a moment important to her in her childhood.
Absolutely, and it's a part of the reason why I love the book so much, and really have a lot of respect and love for Michelle Obama, because I am her. I mean, I'm from Chicago. I know the South Side. That's where I grew up. And that code switching that she talks about is something that I learned very early. My mom was a Chicago public school teacher. I remember going to school with her when I was in elementary school and the kids being like, "You talk white. What's wrong with you?" And, you know, and then going off to my North Side private school, where I had to turn that around, except in cases when it was entertaining to my white classmates. So, you know, there's a lot about where Michelle comes from and her experience that I think resonates because it makes her so human. It makes her so just like me. And I think that that is, you know, it's one of the things that I miss about the Obamas is that I felt like I could relate to them. They were accessible. There was something about their experience that resonated and spoke to my own. And I think, you know, that's what people, you know, that's what connects us. And that's what really makes us able to understand each other, because we see something of ourselves in each other. And I mean, it's no wonder that her book has sold so quickly. It really speaks to people.
The book feels like an exhale.
It does.
There's no election to be won. Yes. Right. There's no legislation attempted to be passed. Right. She can be frank about how she was feeling. So whether that's taking on Christopher Hutchins and the way that he described her dissertation, right, or her thesis, her honors thesis, or even talking about the difficulties that she and Barack had around pregnancy, right, and in vitro fertilization and those kind of dynamics, you know, those kinds of very personal stories connect.
Yeah.
Right, as well as stories about her trying to code switch,
and
trying to fit in these two very different worlds.
I want to switch gears now and talk about a new HBO documentary, Say Her Name, The Life and Death of Sandra Bland. Sandra Bland, 28-year-old African-American woman who, after being arrested for a traffic violation in Texas, was found hanging in her jail cell 3 days later. I want to listen to a clip from the documentary that features some of her video blogs.
Some of us are really doing as much as we can, and we can't help but get pissed off when we see situations where it's clear the black life didn't matter. Because in the news that we've seen as of late, you could stand there, surrender to the cops, and still be killed. It takes love not to go cray-cray over something like that.
There are kings and queens in all of us. What Sandy Speaks wants to do is let my kings and queens know you can do it. We can be successful. It is up to us.
It's a clip from the new HBO documentary, Say Her Name, The Life and Death of Sandra Bland, featuring excerpts from Sandra's Sandy Speaks collection, about 30 video blogs that she recorded in 2015. Natalie, what did you make of this documentary?
Well, I think that I'm really glad that a documentary was made about Sandra Bland's story, because it is one of the instances of police brutality that still really troubles me. Not that the other ones don't, but it just doesn't make any sense. I still grapple with what exactly happened. How did we get from her being pulled over to her being hanging in her jail cell.
Yeah, which nobody saw.
Right.
She's right. They saw evidence. So the evidence is not very clear at all. And there is evidence of, in fact, the sheriff's department admitted that it tampered with some of the documents and some of the records. So, yeah, but unclear.
Yeah. And so the extent to which, you know, the evidence was tampered with, like, we still don't know.
Right.
But, you know, I struggle with the documentary, because I feel like Sandra Bland deserved a little better. I think it's, again, great that HBO decided to do a documentary, that they hired filmmakers to do it. But one of the things that bothers me, and it is, you know, like in the tradition of Oscar So White, it's Doc So White. Documentaries there are so many documentaries that get funded about stories about people of color that white filmmakers decide they want to take on, and they're the ones who get the funding. And when black people want to tell our own stories, somehow the juries don't quite get where we're coming from or why our stories are valuable. And I just feel like this is another instance, you know, where this story of this young black woman really would have been done more justice, I'll say, if someone of color had been able to take it on, because it just feels soulless in a lot of ways. And I think it's just about the nuance and the lack of experience. Like, if you aren't living that person of color life, it's hard to understand unless you're really, really trying to go there. The nuances, like, there's just a lot that's not addressed. And I think that it could have been more powerful if race and class and gender and all these things that intersect in the story had been addressed.
Mark?
The saving grace, I think, for the documentary is, in fact, her own voice.
There you go.
You know, the fact that we have her voice to tell her story, to remind us about her soul in something that could be rendered in some ways so soulless. I think it's important, again, when these documentaries get made and they're in the big ones, that some 13, 14, 15-year-old is watching this and it's going to want to learn the tools to tell stories, that's going to want to be the next Ava DuVernay or the next Natalie Bullock Brown. And it's important to make these stories accessible, right? You know, with everything that's going on, it's easy to forget Sandra Bland.
Yeah.
Right? It's only 3 years ago. Yeah. And watching the footage, particularly of the car stop, and it's like you just get incensed all over again. Right? There was no reason for the stop. There was no reason for the escalation. There's no reason for her to be in
solitary
prison.
She was in this solitary confinement. Again, all of this,
makes no sense.
And that is clear, at least, that it is unclear how all this happened. Mark, very short time, but we lost Nancy Wilson, and she is an amazing artist.
And a favorite of mine. I have like 30 of her albums on vinyl. She always described herself as a stylist, not as a vocalist, someone who could sing anybody else's songs. There are almost 70 albums, the first one in 1960, the last one won a Grammy in 2006. There's not an African-American man, and I'm sure quite a few white males, who did not have a crush on Nancy Wilson in virtually every decade of her public life.
She's a performer.
Yeah, and she was a classy, beautiful lady. Yeah.
On the State of Things, it's Back Channel. There is more with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. We leave this segment with the music of Nancy Wilson.
And you don't know, you don't know, you don't know, you don't know how glad I am. How glad I am. How glad I am. How glad I am.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. It's been 20 years since Lauryn Hill released her first solo album, a blend of rap, hip-hop, R&B, and neo-soul, and it became the soundtrack for a generation. Track from the Grammy Award-winning album The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, the first rap project to win the Grammy for Album of the Year and cited by many as one of the most important recordings of all time. So how exactly did this seminal album come to be? And what impact did it have for young black women and hip-hop heads in particular? These are some of the questions explored by journalist and author Joan Morgan in her new book, She Begat This, 20 Years of the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. And she joins us now. Joan, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. And also with me are Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Joan, you got asked to write this book in the midst of writing your dissertation. When you've been turning down many other projects, why did you say yes to this one?
Well, two reasons. One of them was a very practical one. I have a son who's now a sophomore in college in California. And at the time, when we did the application, I just knew that as the child of two creatives, he would be getting financial aid, and he didn't. Ooh. So I had 42,000 very good reasons to say yes.
Times four,
But also, you know, I never really sign on to doing a longer writing project if I honestly feel that someone else can write it in the way that I would write it. And I could read someone else. And I didn't feel that anyone was really going to take the approach to this album that I would take. And so I really wanted to center the experiences of Black women and use its periodization, the end of the 20th century, almost 20 years into the 21st century, and take a look at where Black women were, where hip-hop was, where hip-hop was in relationship to Black women, and really look at the social and political climate that helped birth this album.
Well, you argue in the book that the album came out at a particularly trying moment in hip-hop. Can you set that context for us?
Sure. So, you know, 1999, we're 3 years after 1996, obviously, where Biggie and Tupac are murdered within 6 months of each other. So there is really this growing sense that hip-hop has become commercially this entity that we could never have imagined. You know, it's a more than billion-dollar industry. And at the same time, there's some real growing pains. There's some real losses from violence. And we're losing our innocence in some sense. As a woman who has always been a part of hip-hop culture, we start to feel as if we're being pushed out of this thing that we help create, and that its financial success has actually come at the expense of making us these sacrificial lambs, the increased misogyny in its lyricism. And, you know, it's like we helped build this thing and it's become the baddest party, the hottest party globally. And now we're not only told that we have to get online with everyone else, we're seeing all these other people who had nothing to do with building the culture being handed VIP bracelets and walking past the velvet rope.
Natalie, what?
So I wanted to explore that.
Natalie, what did you make of this treatment of that work and the work itself? How had you thought about it all this time?
Well, I mean, hi, Joan, first of all. the way that the book is written, it takes me back to the time when Miseducation of Lauryn Hill was released. And I was living in New York at that time. And so I remember, I mean, it's so amazing how it just brings to mind these memories, these very vivid memories of what it felt like to like hear the album for the first time, to hear Lost Ones and, you know, be like, oh my gosh, like she's not taking no prisoners. Lauryn is here and, you know, she's like completely confident and, you know, about the business. And so I really appreciate, I mean, not only is Joan like an amazing writer, but she's a storyteller. And so all the stories that are included, you know, that are woven together in this book just really reminds me of how important that the period of time that she's talking about, you know, when this album was released was. And then, you know, it also sort of jumps forward to now and makes me think about, you know, what is going on at this moment that is similar, or maybe the stage was set in the late 90s for what we see today.
You mentioned Lost Ones, one of the cuts on the album. Let's listen to a little clip from that right here. Hypocrites always want to play in the sand. Always want to take it to the full altitude stand. Always want to make it seem like golden tan. Never want to face it when it's time for punishment. I know you don't want to hear my opinion. Then how many paths and you must choose one. And if you don't change, then the rain soon comes. So you might win some, but you just lost. That's a clip from Lost Ones from Lauryn Hill's seminal 1998 album. And I am talking about it with hip-hop journalist Joan Morgan, who authored the new book, She Begat This, 20 Years of the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Also with me are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. And Joan, you say this song speaks particularly strongest to you and the themes in this book because of how it features her as an MC. Tell us more.
Yeah, you know, I was one of those people who was really disappointed that there wasn't more hip-hop on the Miseducation. you know, there was a lot of, I think that we have come in the course of history to decide that it was a rap album. But when it dropped, there was actually a lot of debate over whether or not this could be considered a rap album. It was the same year that Jay-Z boycotted the Grammys because of its treatment of hip hop. And so there was a lot of controversy over the fact that an album with so much R&B and other musical forms on it was given Best Rap Album, and not so much a criticism of Lauren, but a criticism of the Grammys and its selection policy. But what remains true is that this is probably one of the best battle records and diss tracks of all time. It is so solid that there's not even a response. Like, clearly it was about Wyclef. There could not even be a retort from him. And it is just, usually when women's hearts are broken, the soundtrack is a different kind of sonic treatment. It's the sort of crying of R&B or the heartbreak of soul. It's a different sonic tenor. And this was just rage, and it was beautiful, and it was ballistic. Mm-hmm. And I still put it on whenever I'm mad and I can't actually somebody.
Mark Anthony Neal, what stands out to you about Lauryn Hill's legacy and this treatment of this particular record?
So what's up, homie? How you doing?
Hey, Mark.
So a couple of quick things. You having to make that distinction between the greatness of that album and who Lauryn Hill is, you know, when you're writing the book, where do you make that separation? What kind of choices that you make? How does it impact the type of stories that you choose to tell, since it really is about the legacy of this album and less so a hagiography, if you will, of Lauryn? And then secondly, how important was it for you to identify these other Black women's voices to weigh in on Lauryn's legacy? I mean, that on the one hand for me seems to be like just an incredible gesture on your part to spread the wealth, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, and you didn't have to. So talk a little bit about those particular dynamics.
So, you know, my one, Atria 37 Inc. was only giving me 4 months to write this book. I took 4.5, and that was a thing. Like, it was a thing. Like, the last 4 chapters of the book are written over a course of 10 to 12 days, honestly. So one of the things that I was very clear about them with in the beginning, I said to my editor, I cannot do this book if you require me to speak to Lauryn at all, because anyone that's done celebrity journalism knows that once you throw the actual celebrity into the mix, deadlines are something now that you can't really control. And also, just as a writer, I had to make a real choice. I felt like writing about Lauryn Hill, the person, and her personal life or experiences required interviewing her for sure, and that it was never going to be enough for the audience. Like, whatever she didn't touch on, someone was going to say, well, why didn't you talk about this or why didn't you talk about that? But when it came to, and I actually wasn't really interested in that project, to be quite honest with you, but when it came to the album, I felt that this particular cultural product and the way that it actually shifted culture, and not just Black culture, but even mainstream culture, visual culture, what we now are used to seeing in fashion ads, the way that it precedes a natural hair care movement, that there was more than enough there to just focus on the album and have a pretty solid, solid book. So I chose that. And one of the other reasons that I wanted to do this book, when I said earlier that I didn't think anyone was going to really do it the way that I did it, is that I really wanted, the 90s produced some incredible Black female cultural critics, hip-hop journalists, DJs, people who hold the cultural memory and record. And generally what happens is when these music books are done, it's a very male boys club. And one of us gets called in to be the diversifying voice to give the women's perspective. And I felt that Lauryn's story was our story. Not only could we tell the story, but we were there making the story, you know? I signed these books, We Begat This, because we very much begat the era that begat Lauryn Hill. You know, it's a very symbiotic relationship. So there are only three men in the book, and they're there because they really absolutely had to be. But I didn't feel, I wanted to flip it and give those voices the kind of attention and space that they deserve.
Another part of Mark's question, though, that I wonder about is the idea that, you know, I understand not wanting to talk to the artist itself, especially if they've stood you up a couple of times, which I'm sure is part of your part as a critic you've probably experienced. But the idea, what part, what part is her story the bigger story that you want to tell? And to what extent was it exceptional? Was it not exactly her personal story, her trajectory, her virtual silence after this album comes out? I mean, to what extent is that a part of the larger story, or is it exceptional and not really as central to the larger story you tell?
You know, I my periodization on this is very, very specific. So it's 1998 when the album drops to I think I take it a little bit up to maybe, I want to say 2008, which is when I did a cover story on her for Essence magazine. But I was writing about L Boogie specifically. And I think that the incarnation now that you speak about, her disappearance, who she's become since, is Ms. Lauryn Hill. Mm-hmm. And I had no interest really in writing about Ms. Lauryn Hill. And I don't think I think that when people engage this album, they are engaging L Boogie. They're engaging the experience of 90s hip hop, where women were at that time in the music. And I don't think that they're really engaging L Boogie. I mean, Ms. Lauryn Hill. I think the people who go to her concerts now and are upset about time and, you know, whether she's late or whether she's going to show up, those are the people that are dealing with Ms. Lauryn Hill. I don't go to those concerts. So I wasn't really interested in having to engage that experience. And the stuff that about her personal life that is of public record was easy enough for me to engage. Like the fact her relationship with Wyclef has been written about by him. Her experience of going to jail for tax evasion is public record. The lawsuits were public record. So there wasn't really a whole lot that I needed to get from Lauryn. And quite frankly, she wasn't going to give it to me. She has never spoken really about many of those things in the public record. And there would have been no reason to assume that she was going to want to give it to me for this book and then not want to control the way that I write about it.
Yeah. Natalie?
Joan, I wanted to ask you, as like the originator of hip hop feminism, to what extent do you see Lauryn Hill as a contributor to the forward movement of hip hop feminism? How did she contribute?
You know, I was listening to this album when I wrote Chicken Heads. I listened to Zion through most of my pregnancy. I think that, you know, a lot of people have written about Lauryn as feminist. I never do that. I have never, ever seen her use that word, embrace it, make a statement indicative that that's her political, you know, her particular framing of her pro-woman ideology. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. But I use hip hop feminism very much in a connection with Black feminism and Black feminist theory in a way that I don't think Lauryn fits in easily there. Like, does that mean that I don't think that she's important? No, but I don't really measure her in terms of the F word, so to speak. Mostly because, and I do put Beyonce there, mm-hmm. mostly because she claims the word mm-hmm. and claims the position and claims the advocacy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important.
Joan Morgan is a hip hop journalist and the author of the book She Begat This, 20 Years of the Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Joan Morgan, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Also with me, popular culture experts and back channel contributors, Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, a filmmaker and a teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark is the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. And as I say, you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.
looking back.